Welcome to episode 268 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today is a special interview with Kit Delorier, the first person to ski the seven summits, the highest mountains on each of the planet's seven continents. Long-term listeners to the Ski Podcast will know I like to feature high-achieving women in the world of snow sports. Previous episodes in this series have included interviews with Vicky Gosling, CEO of GB Snowsport, BBC Ski Sunday's Shemi Alcott and founder of YSC Ski Fiona Easdale, as well as the Team GB freestyle athletes Zoe Atkin and Kirsty Muir. I read Kit's book, Higher Love, this summer and was so blown away by her bravery, courage, determination and quite frankly, her incredible organisation that I knew straight away I wanted to share her story with you, the listeners of the Ski Podcast. I hope you'll agree that it's an inspiring tale. During our conversation, Kit covers her background in skiing. She's a former Freeride World Tour champion, as well as explaining the logistical, physical and physiological challenges she faced while tackling the seven summits. Before I go on to my interview with Kit, I would like to thank Tyrol in Austria for sponsoring the Ski Podcast this winter. There are over 80 resorts and 3,400 kilometres of ski runs in the Tyrol. It's been great fun finding more about them already this winter, and there's more to come. Right, let's have a listen to my interview with Kit Delorier, the first person to ski the seven summits. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Kit Delorier, the American ski mountaineer, who in 2006 became the first person to ski down all seven summits, the highest seven mountains on each continent. And if you hadn't guessed, she's not only an extremely experienced mountaineer, but she's an expert skier who is also a two-time world free skiing champion. Now, I'm looking forward to finding out about both of those amazing achievements during this podcast and plenty more. Hi, Kit. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm still carrying a cough I got from the London Snow Show, which is a really busy time just now. I'm in Brighton on the south coast of England. Whereabouts are you today?
Well, at the moment, I am just outside of Boise, Idaho. But I do live in Wyoming, in Wilson, Wyoming, and I've lived there for 25 years. But I'm here in Idaho visiting a friend.
Right. Well, they're both beautiful parts of the world. I went to Idaho a couple of years ago and got to experience some of that wilderness that you have out there. I think probably you'd say the same for Wyoming as well. You're obviously living your life in ski resorts. Question I do like to ask my guests when they're on the show is, when did you ski or snowboard last? I'm guessing it probably hasn't happened this season yet, unless you've been ski touring. So maybe last season, was it?
Last season it was. I ski usually into the beginning of June. So that's actually when it was. I remember it clearly, in Grand Teton National Park. And no, I'm one of those skiers who doesn't ski early season. I've had a number of close calls early season. With that shallow snowpack, you can, at no fault of your own, get really injured. So I tend to extend my season longer than most and start it after some of those most eager.
Nice. And I'm guessing then if you were skiing in June, that wasn't lift serve skiing. You were touring or hiking up to some snow, were you?
Yes, I tour more than I ski at resorts these days. And sometimes that depends on the weather, of course, right? If we're getting in a really big cycle and things are too dangerous out there, then I'll ski at resorts a bit. But I definitely ski far more than 50% of my time human powered in the backcountry.
Fantastic. I love ski touring, but I'm not quite going that far yet. But I do love going up as much as I love going down. Whereabouts was that skiing in June?
Grand Teton National Park.
Excellent. Well, I recently read your brilliant book, Higher Love, Climbing and Skiing the Seven Summits. It was actually suggested to me by a listener a few years ago when Jim and I used to run the ski book club feature. And I'm so sorry, listener, I can't remember who it was who suggested it. So if it was you, well, firstly, apologise for getting your name. And secondly, thanks very much. Because for whatever reason, I only ended up reading it this summer. And I was completely blown away. It's such an incredible achievement. And as soon as I finished, I think I dropped you an email to see if we could arrange for you to come on the podcast. I think before we come into it in any detail, it might be useful if you could just remind us which those seven summits are. I think probably most people are going to know some of them, but they might not be aware of all of them.
Seven summits represent the highest mountain on each continent. And in North America, it's Denali. And in Europe, it's Elbrus. Some people think that it's Mont Blanc, which I have also skied, but it is Elbrus, which is technically in Russia. Then there's Vincent Massif in Antarctica, Aconcagua in South America, Kilimanjaro in Africa. Kosciuszko is Australia, which if people read my book, you'll understand there the debate. Some people like to identify Karsten's pyramid as either the seventh or technically the eighth, if you want to do the eight pack there instead of the seven pack. And then, of course, Everest, the highest in the world, which is in Asia on the border of Nepal and Chinese Tibet. Well,
I'm pretty sure everybody has heard of Everest and probably a few of those other peaks. I'm certainly aware that there are people who think that Mont Blanc is the highest mountain in Europe, but Mount Elbrus, 5,642 metres. And generally, I'm going to refer to metres in this podcast. So, you know, the only thing for me, being a European, trying to get my head around the constant references to feet in your book, I had to do converting in my mind the whole time.
That was an editing question. I understand that. I appreciate it because I mostly work in meters myself.
Right. Okay. Well, Everest is clearly the highest. Aconcagua, next highest. Denali, I think, actually, which possibly some people in America want to rename at the moment, but 6,194 meters and then the others. I think probably the obvious way to tackle how you skied those seven summits is to do it in chronological order. But I think it would be interesting for listeners to find out a little bit more about your background in skiing, because I think it's evident you need to be an extremely strong skier, let alone mountaineer, to be able to take on this sort of a challenge. I wondered where and when you learned to ski. How old were you and whereabouts was that?
Oh, this is a fun one because it usually blows people's minds that I did not grow up with skis on my feet at all. I did grow up. By the time I was, maybe 6 or 7 or 8, I had exposure to cross-country skis. And even then, never a discipline of, you know, on a formal track or any kind of racing. For me, it was walking around in the woods and farmers' fields with a sense of freedom. That was, you know, for me as a kid, they understood that if I was out with my cross-country skis, then I would be back by dinner and dark, right? That was a bit of my freedom. And nothing structured about it, but I loved it. And what I really loved was being outdoors in winter and finding freedom and connection to the natural world that way. And I was 14 before I ever had the opportunity to go downhill skiing.
So many people I speak to on the podcast, you know, started when they were 3 or 4 or something like that. But you were doing cross-country skiing. Whereabouts in the country was that?
At that time, we lived in Massachusetts and also in a little corner of slightly remote Long Island. So those two. And then we moved out to Arizona and I did some out there. And that's actually where I first put downhill skis, alpine skis on my feet, was at a little resort called Sunrise, run by the Apache in northeastern Arizona.
That's amazing. I think most listeners probably would have no idea that you could go skiing in Arizona. It doesn't sound like the sort of state where it'd be possible, but I'm trying to remember one of the other resorts there. Is Snowbowl a resort in Arizona?
It is. It's in Flagstaff. So Arizona's got this really interesting topography where when you get to about the top third, the northern third of the state, there is a feature called the Mogollon Rim that runs across it, and you're really moving up into four seasons there.
Fantastic. I also read you spent a bit of time skiing in Europe once you'd started. Maybe I know you went to university in Arizona, but at some point after that, you came over to Europe and did a bit of skiing over here. Where were you based then?
It was actually during university that I went over there. I'd been studying French since I was, 13 or 14. And I went for a bit one summer when I was 15. To Europe and studied at a language school. And then when I was 19 and in college at University of Arizona in Tucson, and I just needed a little bit of more adventure in my life. And I decided to take a semester and go to the University of Marseille in Aix-en-Provence. And when I was there, we had a 2-week break where I hitchhiked up to Verbier and met up with an American expat that had been suggested to me that I call up for an adventure during some time off. And then I was introduced to that community up in Verbier in the little town of Colomban above there. And I couldn't get my mind off of it. So even though I was, Dean's honor list of everything in academia came easy to me and I adored it and was committed to it, I spent a semester not receiving any academic credits, dropped out of the University of Marseille in Aix, and went found myself for a solid month learning to ski tour up in Verbier before I went back to the University of Arizona in Tucson and jumped back in to finish college. And that was when I was like, I'm out. I'm going to finish college and I'm going to move to the mountains. And that's how I moved to Telluride, Colorado the day after I graduated.
Right, cool. Well, I mean, you picked an amazing resort to go to in terms of Verbier. I absolutely love the backcountry skiing there. And I think that sometimes if people have come from the States, they tend to be quite surprised at how open the backcountry is, perhaps relative to out of bounds skiing in North America.
That's true. We would go out of bounds and stay a night in a hut and go down a whole different direction. You know, it was amazing. And where I have landed at Jackson Hole in Wyoming is similar in some ways in our backcountry access. So that's an interesting parallel I've never drawn before, but it's fun to live that right now.
Oh, well, an amazing place, and also perhaps the home of free skiing in Europe, which we'll come on to a little bit later on as well. I wonder whether that was any influence on you. You mentioned then after you came back and finished university, did you say you moved to Telluride?
I did. The day after I graduated college, I drove that 12 hours north, which I had done consistently for the prior 2 years for long weekends. I was committed to furthering my skiing craft, and it took many years. In hindsight, if I look back and say, how long did it take for me to become an expert skier? I'd say it was probably 29 years old. So probably a good 10 years after I started really focusing on it, which was that focus came during that trip to Verbier. Of course, yeah, allow uphill travel at Verbier. So that was big. Mm-hmm. That was where I did a side job modeling, which I did at the time for a Japanese ski clothing company. And I made enough cash to go out and buy myself a pair of touring skis and boots. And at that time, they were Telemark. And that's what my friends up in Verbier were using. And so I would uphill ski at Verbier and then go ski out in the backcountry. And that was really how I learned.
That's really cool. Sorry, you were skiing Telemark when you're in Verbier.
I know, me too. But sometimes if we do hard things and we do them well, then the easier things are more fun.
I love that. Would that have been in the sort of mid-90s then?
Yes, it was. Yes.
I was actually working seasons myself at the same time over in Mirabel and Courchevel around that time. And I did go over to Verbier from time to time. So you never know, we might have passed each other on the slopes. Or maybe, did you ever go to Chamonix or to the Bosse-de-Bosse or anything like that?
Yes, I did. Chamonix, the Heilbronner. I loved the Heilbronner. I still do.
Right.
I've skied around there quite a bit. And I love it and have gone back to Chamonix many times since, usually for extended, you know, 3 week trips, because it's a very special place. And in the last 10 years, I've fallen in love with Alanya, to tell you the truth.
I've skied in Alanya as well. I did some heli skiing over there, some great access to points like Monte Rosa, etc. And the further end of the Aosta Valley is relatively undiscovered. The free ride area between Alanya and Monte Rosa is fantastic.
It is.
But don't tell anyone.
Right.
Cool. So when you went back to Telluride, I mean, you said, you know, in your mind, you didn't become an expert skier till, you know, you're in your late 20s. But you were on the ski patrol in Telluride. Is that right?
Yes, I was. That was a goal of mine, right? I hadn't been introduced to downhill alpine skiing until I was 14. And in those years, it was really 1 or 2 weeks a year was the only opportunity I would have to travel from, right, Arizona to someplace like Sun Valley or Park City to ski for a week, or eventually Telluride for a week here and there. So when I graduated from college and went to Telluride, I still had a long way to go with my skiing, even though I had learned a lot that bit in Verbier. And I just was wondering, how could I do this? How can I find the time and the discipline with time in my life to get to be truly an expert skier? And I looked around and I saw people working ski patrol, and I thought, I wonder if I could do that. And it took me a couple of years of discipline with my skiing to feel like I was ready to go for that. And they also hadn't actually had a hiring clinic in years, because it's a really coveted position. And at the time, I also volunteered intensely for search and rescue. So I had my wilderness EMT, emergency medical technician, as well as other helicopter rescue certifications at the time, which those I haven't kept current, but my wilderness first responder I've kept current for all these years. So that gave me a leg up, and I was definitely a good enough skier, and I got a job on ski patrol, which some ways, sadly, I only decided to keep for two seasons, because then I started getting invited on international expeditions to go climbing and skiing, and there was a necessary overlap in the calendar there, right? You want to be beginning your travel to go international places for big ski expeditions sometime in March.
It's really interesting following your development as a skier there. You know, building up your experience through Europe and Telluride on the ski patrol. And you said you were a relatively, you know, late starter to skiing in the first place, you know, not considering yourself an expert till your late 20s. But I don't think there's many people who join the World Free Skiing Tour in their mid-30s. You know, you won it a couple of times in a row. But I'm interested. Were you competing before you joined the world circuit?
Never. I had never competed. And what happened for me was I moved to Jackson Hole, age 29, 30 in there. I like to say that I evolved my skiing. I intentionally evolved my skiing to match the scale and beauty of my surroundings. Telluride is incredibly beautiful and the scale is large. However, in the Tetons, the mountains are just, there's more of them that are more intense. I just kept working on my skiing there and I looked around and the tram, the lift access is also very much so more intense. So I looked around there and I just didn't see other women at that time skiing the way that I was skiing. So honestly, joining the World Free Skiing Tour, a big piece of it for me was wanting to meet other women that could ski like I did, because I was only skiing with men. And it was the other piece of it was that I always wanted to win something. And I wondered what it felt like to win something. So that's in there why that kind of maybe 4-year gap or something, to the point where I felt like I had a chance to stand on the podium. I don't like to do things until, I don't know. I can't say I don't like to do things if I'm not good at them. I very much do. I love the learning and beginning mindset. But if I was going to go out and compete skiing, I waited until I felt like I deserved a spot there. And so I actually got a wild card to enter because I had been out free skiing and had met then organizer of the free skiing tour. And I asked for a bye, a wild card to enter the world tour that year, because I didn't want to mess around with a whole year of qualifying. And he basically said, don't tell anyone, but now it's been long enough, so I'm just going to say that, but I won't name them. Don't tell anyone and don't make me regret it. And that was my very first year on the tour. I won the overall point title and then went back the second year to repeat.
I love that. I mean, to clarify, I think you were already a North Face, the North Face sponsored athlete by then. You mentioned you were doing expeditions and things like this. It's not like you're a sort of nobody who'd come into the sport.
I was a nobody who had come into the sport, very much so. And I was a nobody who was already married at age 34, which both of those things are not sexy to the ski industry. I didn't even have a ski sponsor, much less a contract with a company like the North Face. I had been on a couple of ski expeditions, one in particular that already that had been sponsored by the North Face, and that was to Siberia, to Mount Palooka in 1999. After which I asked for 5 consecutive years. I asked the North Face for a spot on the athlete team and was not granted it until I was poised to win the World Free Skiing Tour the second consecutive year.
Yeah, by then they realized that they were a little bit behind the game. And
well, I basically put out a little bit of an ultimatum. I was like, look, I'm doing this and I'm going to win again this year. And I'm also in this 7 Summits project, and I believe in this brand. I love this brand. And I've been on what I would lovingly call the B team for a number of years, right? A little bit of a product flow, but could not honestly say that I was sponsored by the North Face then yet. And I said, hey, please, let's just do this. And that's how the North Face contract began 21 years ago.
Cool. Well, you know, winning the World Free Skiing Tour is obviously an amazing achievement. I think it's while you were competing on that circuit. I mean, you've already referred to the 7 Summits. that idea kind of came to you? I think I'm right in saying it started when you decided to do the Denali trip, which was the first. And when you decided to do Denali, it wasn't part of the Seven Summits project. It was a project to ski Denali, right?
That's correct. It was flat out vacation for me. That's what I like to do in my shoulder season, right? For the skiers, you understand the concept of shoulder season. It's just not the peak season. And it's not the summer unless you live in a different hemisphere. So for me, I just went to Denali as a one-off vacation, basically. Let's go winter camping and ski Denali. And so Denali, I didn't even have the Seven Summits on my radar in 2004 when I had done the Denali and the first free skiing tour championship. So what happened for me was in 2005 when I was gunning for that second tour title, I had won the U.S. Free Skiing Nationals at Snowbird, and Mr. Dick Bass handed me my award, and he, rest in peace, he had owned and developed Snowbird Ski Resort, and I ended up having dinner with him that night. The next morning, I checked out of his hotel, the Cliff Lodge at Snowbird, and he had left a signed copy of his book, The Seven Summits, for me at the checkout. And when I read that throughout the rest of the season, that literally traveled with me and was on my nightstand. And I read that book, and there's a piece in my mind that would transpose every story in that into the visual for me of what it might look like to ski those mountains, which he had climbed. And I also loved the serendipity, if you will, that he had done Denali as a one-off and I had done it the year before. And that's when I came up with the idea that, hey, maybe these mountains are skiable.
I love that. But I also know, you know, from your book, which is fantastic. I'll put links in. In fact, I've got it right next to me here.
Fantastic.
You kept it to yourself to start off with. You know, it must have been quite difficult, like even kept that as a secret from your parents, right?
I did. You know, if I was, if I wanted to go deeper into the physics of what happens when we talk about our plans and goals and aspirations, I might be able to comment on this more scientifically, but I can comment on it experientially for sure. And it's that when we say something out loud about what we're hoping, planning, dreaming for, there's a piece of that energy that's given out to the universe already, if you will. And this was a big enough, bold enough project. And it mattered so much to me that I kept it to myself because I didn't want that experience that I had already played around with and had direct knowing that some of it energy dissipates, if you will. And the other piece is that, you know, honestly, if at any point it didn't work out or no longer felt right, then I was going to walk away from it. And I just didn't want to have to explain myself to anybody else. I didn't do it for anybody else. And luckily I didn't have to go out and sell t-shirts to be able to afford to do it, in which case I would have had to say things publicly and raise money. So there are a couple of reasons in there.
You did allude to the financial side of things. In the book, you often refer to a kind of secret sponsor who made it a possible. Has enough time passed to be able to say who that was yet?
No, and that that rule for me is self-imposed. It's not from the person I call my angel sponsor. I just follow my own morals and ethics, and I do unto others as you would have done unto you. And I see no need to name that person. However, you know, I was working as a stonemason and had been a ski patroller. And at the end of every year, I knew where every dollar went, even if, you know, 55 of them went directly to one new Camelot for rock climbing. And so I didn't have any extra money to throw at a project like this. So that person was incredibly important to me.
That's absolutely fine that you want to keep them to yourself. But I love the fact that, you know, there was someone out there who made it possible. So evidently, once you conceived the idea, you wanted to do this. The logistics are extremely complicated. You've obviously got to travel around the world. And in most cases, you have to be there at a specific time of year to be able to summit, let alone ski. You know, it's not just whacking some skins on and going up. For most of these mountains, you need a full support crew. You've got to know routes. You know, you've got to have food, tents, weather, climbing permits, etc. How did you go about deciding the order that you're going to take on the different summits?
I was incredibly committed, Ian. And with this angel sponsor, the plan was that I basically had to build a business plan, I'll say, and send that to that person. And the response was, wow, this is amazing. And as that person is also a business person, their response was, let's take it one at a time. And I'm in. I'm in for the whole project, but let's take them one at a time. So I did the overall research and I did intensive research on each one as needed, always looking forward, kind of like skiing and climbing a mountain. I was always looking ahead, but I was incredibly focused on that, which was right in front of me. So the overall plan I created, and then each one, I continued to research and build each one as its own independent portion of the plan, and submit a budget and a plan for each mountain. And that's how I did it. And it is an interesting point you bring up. Is a very big part of it for me is that there was no precedent for me to find online, right? Similar to reading Dick Bass's book and having to turn everything around in my head to think about the seasons and the conditions and the routes. And I had to do that for each mountain. No history existed for me to pull from. And so it's funny, a lot of people reach out to me and they're like, they want beta on a particular mountain. And I'm like, well, you know, maybe I give some here and there. And sometimes, depending on my mood, I suggest that they learn to figure things out on their own, because that's a big part of the joy of it for me. And it's also kind of like, I consider myself an amateur meteorologist and everything else with what I do. Even if I'm just talking about locally skiing in Grand Teton National Park. So you have to be able to study all aspects.
Sure. And, you know, you refer to the weather there because, you know, for all of your planning, the weather itself is something that you can't control. You can have your plan. And, you know, later on when we come to talk about, you know, Everest, we can look at that in real detail. But thinking, you mentioned, okay, you climbed Denali first. Thinking, just going through them, in terms of Elbrus, you mentioned the weather. Now, if I recall it correctly, you had some absolutely terrible conditions when you were climbing Elbrus.
The climbing Elbrus wasn't so terrible. It was, well, okay. It was the last couple of hours of climbing Elbrus that we climbed right into a really dangerous storm. Yes. But the bulk of the climbing for the day and a half before that wasn't terrible. But we did climb right into the kind of storm that people die on up there. And then we got to turn around and ski away from it. But from the summit, we were already in it. Yeah, it was really dangerous. And then we got trapped at a high camp for a few days while we waited for it to pass.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a line in the book somewhere. I don't know whose quote it is, but it says it's not the summits that will kill you. It's the summit attempts. You know, if it's not the right day, you have to be prepared to turn back. And that's something you come across. And you mentioned how dangerous Elbrus could be. I interviewed Dan Egan a couple of years ago, and he had a pretty kind of horrific experience on the same mountain, right?
Oh, yes. We were talking about Dan Egan and thinking about him as we were climbing into the last couple hours of that storm. We literally were like, okay, this is right about where he built this snow cave and barely got away with his life. And I do know Dan Egan fairly well and count him as a friend. So it is a really dangerous place. And sometimes you do have to turn around. But the majority of the time you have to decide if you're going to dig deep and how much you're going to risk. And to be perfectly honest, there's plenty of times when all of your risk assessments, you have them, you understand them, and you also just have to accept that you're going to go beyond.
We're never going to be able to cover each climb in detail, but the point of this podcast is to recommend people to the book and to read about it for themselves. But thinking about the Vinson Massif in Antarctica, okay, you had terrible conditions on Elbrus, but it seemed like unimaginably low temperatures when you're in Antarctica, as low as minus 40 Celsius.
Absolutely. And winds that we were at the high camp trapped up there for a good 4 days, in the middle of which we actually made a summit attempt, but it turned around. So it was day 5 from high camp where we made it to the summit. During that storm that trapped us up there, where we ran out of food and water and breakfast sometimes was a single chocolate covered espresso bean soaked in water, we had no way to measure temperatures or communicate with base camp. We later learned upon our return that at base camp, 7,000 feet below, the temperatures were minus 35 and winds were 7,000 feet below us. So we don't know exactly what it was where we were.
It was extremely cold, not the sort of temperatures that humans go out in. At some point, you know, you're trying to ski You mentioned in the book how, you know, regular ski boots, you know, they're made of plastic, typically. They don't perform so well in the cold. So you had these massive neoprene overboots that you used on your ski boots.
Yes, I own three different gauges of neoprene for those. I have more neoprene ski boot covers than I have wetsuits for surfing, that's for sure. They're made for climbing boots. I have to adapt them for my ski boots, which means I cut out receiving holes in the toes for the pins of my bindings and again in the heels. And then I laboriously coat those holes in a rubber tool dip repeatedly inside and out and let them dry. And that's how I can wear them in my ski boots. And those big purple ones are, I don't know, I'm going to say at least probably 4 mil.
So Antarctica, incredibly cold. You basically went, as far as I can recall, almost straight from Antarctica to South America to ski Aconcagua. That just because the timings worked, it fitted into your plan, had to be done then. Is that right?
Yes, that's a piece of it. And again, back to the being an amateur meteorologist, I had been doing a lot of research on if Aconcagua is even skiable. I didn't just want to try and jump over dirt patches on the regular route. I wanted to ski the Polish Glacier, and it's rarely, if ever, in condition. And this was the biggest snow year that they had had, right? We're talking Southern Hemisphere. So that summer was their biggest snow year in 20 years. And I didn't want to miss that. So there were, and the other reason was I was very cognizant and respectful of the budget that was I was asking for the Seven Summits project from my angel sponsor. It just made sense to me to, for a lot of reasons, to go from Antarctica to Argentina without coming back up to North America in between. I had a day to do laundry and buy some flip-flops and try and heal a little bit of the frost damage to my toes, and then continued on to Aconcagua.
Right. Well, at least you had some residual altitude acclimatization on board. You mentioned that was a really good snow season, another reason for doing it. But in a lot of these situations, when you're incredibly high points on mountains, it's not what most people would think of as a straightforward slope to ski. And sometimes, and I think this happened on Aconcagua, you need to be belayed, otherwise it would be just too dangerous. And it sounds like it's extremely difficult to ski on a belay, not just for the person who's at the other end of the rope, but for you as well, to get the timing right.
Yes. And it's fun to remember that I had never taken a ski belay before that moment. So there I was learning how to ski on belay at 21,000 feet. It was just a short pitch. Was able to ski the summit, down the summit ridge for quite a bit until on nice, easy terrain, except for it was incredibly frozen and cold. And I was tired until it was time to drop into the upper part, into this bowl that begins below that several hundred feet or, good 150 meters below the summit ridge. You get into a tight rock chute couloir constriction. So in that funnel up there of that little bowl, there was incredible avalanche danger. The wind had redeposited snow and made some hard surfaces that were breaking loose into big pancakes. And the consequences for being caught in there were extreme, to be pushed through those rock chutes. And so I accepted a ski belay there, and it was very steep. It wasn't straightforward at all. It was concave, and the rope is like always trying to get caught in your skis as you're making jump turns, and you're never sure which turn is going to break loose and you might have to exit from. And so you have that rope problem there too. And, you know, I definitely question if it's even worth it, but the consequences had me decide that it would be worth it for probably about 30 turns. And then I unclipped from the rope.
It's almost impossible to imagine for, let's say, us normal skiers, but such an incredible achievement overall, and some of the conditions that you tackled. Thinking about Kilimanjaro, which came a little bit later on, you know, this is a mountain that probably maybe quite a few listeners to the podcast, you know, might have climbed it. It's relatively accessible. Not quite as simple as far as the skiing is concerned as, you know, I read the book. I mean, two issues there. One, there being enough snow to actually ski on. And two, the possibility of skiing actually being prohibited. How did you get around that?
In some ways, I'll say I didn't get around it. I just did it. I tried. The first time I tried. That's the only mountain that I climbed twice in this project that didn't work out the first time to ski. And that's because I had requested permission from Kilimanjaro National Park Association, KNAPA, to ski. And that's because in my extensive study, I had learned that skiing is not allowed on Kilimanjaro. It's called a pleasure-seeking device, skiing is, along with many other things, right? Like base jumping or other things up there. So I applied for permission and had intended to go to Kilimanjaro directly after Elbrus, which was successful in its first attempt. Got back to Munich on my way out of from Elbrus from Russia and got the email that I had been denied. So that first time I just went and skied it, figured, well, I'm already in. I've got some non-recoverable resources into that and I might as well just go and check it out and climb it. But I didn't want to risk anybody's livelihood there. And in Kilimanjaro, you have to have local guides. So I had respected that and had local guides planned for the climb. It was a hard decision for me to not bring skis. I did actually rush through town in Munich and buy some snow blades and took them with me thinking maybe I'll just sneak them. But my morals got the best of me towards the when it was time to depart Arusha for Kilimanjaro, and I didn't take them with me. So that first time was just recon, I'll say. And then I applied a second time for the permit. And at that point, I was denied again. I had switched organizers, expedition organizers, and at that point had accepted to work with Wally Berg of Berg International, because I had chosen him for my Everest expedition that I was concurrently planning. And he really believed that we could get a permit. When we didn't get that permit, he went off on a limb and said that he would make my ski descent happen. I just had to let go of knowing how. So I showed up in Arusha and handed my skis over in an unmarked bag and didn't see them again until the summit. And I'm hoping right now that enough time has passed that I don't have repercussions for that. I wrote about it in the book, so there you go.
Yeah, I know about it because it's in the book. And, you know, I kind of love to let the listener know what happened was, as far as I understood it, you know, one of the team rolled up the skis in a carpet and then carried them up the mountain like that. So you hadn't seen them at all during the climb. And then they appear at the summit and you get the opportunity to ski. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, that was a way of resolving that. And I haven't mentioned Kosciuszko in here because, you know, to my mind, it's not, I mean, certainly the lowest of all of those mountains. It's not a particularly difficult one. So therefore, moving on to the final one, the, you know, the highest mountain in the world. Was Everest always going to be the last on the list? Was that a, you know, obvious finale?
I did not want Everest to be the last on the list. I wanted to be successful with this project, and it just seemed wrong to me to leave Everest last on the list if that was my ultimate goal. But that's how it worked out. If I don't include Denali in this chronology, this whole project took me 18 months. Everest, for me, there was only one time of year to do that, and it would be September, October, post-monsoon. And there's two reasons for that. One is it's incredibly crowded in May, so I can't speak to the experiences in May other than what we all know for in the media and friends and colleagues who have been there that time of year. I wanted to go when there was nobody else on the mountain to get in my way and, you know, have to work around. And I also don't like crowds. I didn't want to be put myself at greater risk for all these different reasons. But also back to the amateur meteorology, there's more snow that comes into the Himalayas in the summer than any other time of year. That's their monsoon. So I was banking on that post-monsoon, there would be more snow. So for all those reasons, Everest had to be a September-October trip, which if I'm really going to get this done in a year and a half, by the time I get started, that's how long it takes to plan Everest. So it was the last. And in hindsight, I was glad it was because I learned a lot along the way. I had a lot of experience to draw from, like those cold conditions we just talked about in Vincent Massif in Antarctica. You know, I had experience with a solid 2 weeks winter camping at, you know, minus 40. And that's also what it takes to do Everest in the post-monsoon season, learning how to do that risk analysis and then let it go out the second story window.
The risk analysis side of things is clearly an issue because, you know, evidently people know that Everest has a death zone within it, and it's clearly going to be the most difficult going higher, walking to the top, you know, with skis as well. You mentioned, you know, clearly you need to have the support of guides, a team with you. In the book, you detail that your guide then, I think, is it Dave Hahn? You kind of had a contract between you about, you know, the decisions that you would make in terms of being able to ski the mountain.
I have a lot of friends who are guides, and I have a lot of respect for the guide industry. And I don't prefer being guided. I move in the mountains in my own very personal relationship with the mountains, and having a guide, if I don't need them, puts a distance for me into that experience. And that experience is not only like the most meaningful for me, but I'm also aware that that's a critical part of my success is being able to have that relationship with the mountains and the natural world on my own terms. The reason I chose Dave, and I would say he was loosely a guide. He was really only a guide for the upper mountain for this one section. That was what our contract was. I didn't need or want a guide for the rest of it. And I wasn't even sure I needed or wanted a guide for the upper part, but that factored into my risk analysis because in studying the Hillary Step, I just didn't think that that was a good idea, right? Again, coming on my experiential knowledge, especially of Aconcagua, where Damien Benegas, who was on foot at the time, is the one who gave me that short belay into the Polish glacier. I wanted to be able to have a belay if I wanted it and needed it down the Hillary Step because I intended to ski the Hillary Step. So that was the conversation with Dave Hahn. Hey, can we hire you for this? And will you be basically a teammate of ours for the rest of it? Which was not an easy thing to negotiate throughout those weeks. We were at or above base camp on Everest for 7 weeks, 49 days. So there were a lot of days in there of interesting partnership with Dave, where he was part of our team, and it was Rob Delaurier and Jimmy Chin and I that were intending on skiing. So yeah, we did have a guide, and it was Dave, and it was really just hopefully for a little section up there.
I mean, you referred to, you know, the length of time for that trip, and you detail your plan, you know, how it worked out in reality later on, but you spend a lot of time acclimatizing, you know, staying at base camp, trips up to C1, back down, trips up to C2, back down, always returning lower, then moving up to camp two, back to base camp, 2-3, back to base camp, and then the final push, 2-3-4 to summit. Now, that's a plan. And, you know, I found it really interesting to read in the book there that I think at one point I read that an unacclimatized person, if they went straight to the summit or C4, they'd only last a few minutes. You literally can't do this without that acclimatization. But just before we come on to how that worked in practice, I was also really interested to read about, I don't know how you put it, an encounter you had on the route up to Everest, which led you to question your reasons for doing the whole seven summits.
Oh, I love that you brought that up. It's, for me, traveling to these places, it is about the skiing, of course, but it's about immersion in the culture. And it's about, for me, a way of experiencing the world and meeting people and learning more about myself and the rest of the world. And for us, when we went to Everest Base Camp, we stopped in a little village on the way up and had so this was on our 10-day trek in. We had a really special 3-hour meeting one morning with Lama Geshe, who has now since passed on, but I did get to meet him again about 7 years ago. Took my kids up to Everest Base Camp and we got to meet Lama Geshe while he was still alive. He was an incredible human and a high-level Tibetan Buddhist. And his role for us was to give us a blessing to move higher on the mountain, which is customary. It used to be customary. I'm not sure how many people really embark on that these days or jump into that and embrace it, especially knowing that people like choose to fly to base camp and acclimatize at home in tents, which if that's what you want to do, That is fine by me. When we met Lama Geshe, he didn't just give us this blessing, which included special amulets he had made for us and prayed upon and put special items inside of and sewn with great loving care and embroidered, and we wore them around our necks, protection amulets, which I still wear from time to time in dangerous moments in life with intention. In addition to that, he gave us a series of what I can now call teachings. And in those teachings, that was his Buddhist PhD level, imparting knowledge and wisdom upon us in the form of rhetorical questions, such as, why do you wish to climb Choma Lungma? His answer to us, as we gave appropriate pauses in consideration of what was going through each of our own minds, he said, you must have the benefit of other sentient beings at the root of the reason for whatever you do if you wish to have continued success. And he also gave us other pieces of very important knowledge and wisdom to consider, which we very much did higher on the mountain, which was slow the prayer flags down. And the prayer flags are, you know, blowing throughout that region, right? The Buddhist culture in the upper reaches of the Himalayas often string prayer flags between poles in important places and across bridges in dangerous places. And the wind is obviously blowing and those prayer flags are blowing and there's prayers written on the flags. And the concept that he went on to explain to us when we looked at him kind of sideways, like, what do you mean slow the prayer flags down? He said, as if you were sitting by a body of moving water, like that river, and you wanted to slow the water down. What he meant is slow our thoughts down. So as we were climbing the mountain and, you know, the wind is just howling to the point where you can't even see your cramponed boot at the bottom of your leg moving up the mountain because it's just everything's blowing so intensely. And, you know, wind, some readers, listeners may not understand that the wind has a greater capacity to transport snow than snow falling out of the sky. So it's just moving all around, and we would, each one of us kind of losing it in our own minds, right, with the thoughts. And we would look out loud, we look at each other and say, slow the prayer flags down. And we would laugh and be kind of transported back into the moment and the joy and beauty of it.
That is great. And I love that metaphor. And evidently, if you read the book, you'll see that it was important as well, because I mentioned, you know, you have a plan. You had a plan for acclimatizing, going up to the different camps. But what you can't do anything to control is weather. And you mentioned you get more snow at that time of year, but you had some pretty heavy snowstorms. You know, at points, a new route had to be made through the Khumbu Glacier, had to put new ladders in, etc. One thing I did want to ask you about is, I think this was just before you summited, you got a call from Megan Carney. I wondered if you wanted to explain who she is and why that was important to you.
That was so important to me. Megan Carney is a Canadian woman who had made the only other female attempt to ski Everest. My ski descent was in 2006 and her attempt was in 2003. It's worth noting that there had only been two attempts in the previous 6 years in that post-monsoon cycle. In 2000, that team had been successful in climbing it. In 2003, they had not. And in 2003, that was when Megan was trying to ski it. We all are tough when we do what we do. And when you're a woman, sometimes you feel like maybe you need to have even another layer of armor out there in a man's world. I'm getting just literally goosebumps up and down my legs right now, remembering that moment. This was relayed to me via satellite phone. It was a message that she sent to Wally Berg at base camp while I was at Camp 3 getting ready to go for Camp 4 in the summit. And Megan had written to Wally to please share with me that she believed in me and that I could do it. And she was rooting for me. And that was incredibly special and really, really a beautiful thing and lesson in connection and vulnerability and support for one another.
Humanity as well, just fantastic. And I'm sure it helped inspire you, you know, for that final step to the summit. And you did get to the summit. Am I right to say that at that point the porters still didn't really believe that you were actually going to put your skis on and ski from there?
Yeah. Well, technically they're Sherpa at that point. Porters are generally the people that we employ to help get our gear to a non-technical place on the mountain. And then we had a team of Sherpa with us. We were the only people on the mountain at the time. We had left one Sherpa as a camp cook at 21,000 feet at Camp 2. And other than that, we had just our climbing team at Camp 4. So we had there were no other resources, human resources anywhere on the mountain at the time. When we went to the summit, we had to be so committed that we actually had to backtrack and clean some ropes that we had fixed on summit day and take them higher. Like we were pretty exposed as a small team. I should say that I always carry my own skis. Always. I carry my own skis. I don't use helicopters unless on the rare occasion I'm powder skiing someplace like Wigley's in Canada, but that's very rare. It's not my preferred way. It was all human powered. I carry my own gear, carry my own oxygen. It was highly suggested/somewhat insisted that we allow a Sherpa to carry each of our skis on summit day. And the reason for that is for safety, we decided we needed two oxygen tanks. Most people would only carry one. In order for us to have two oxygen tanks and skis, we'd probably be carrying a prohibitive amount of weight to then be able to safely ski. And safely ski is already a bit of an oxymoron up there. So we decided to allow the Sherpa to carry our skis on summit day because they only needed one oxygen tank. We carried two. We stashed an oxygen tank at the South Summit. At the summit, I had this amazing opportunity where a very special human being for each one of us handed us our skis. And when I was handed my skis, they were beyond incredulous. In fact, they completely believed that this was all just a prank to get my skis to the top and I wasn't going to ski. So handed me the skis and said, hey, Kami will carry them down. Because Dasona, who had carried mine, our lead climbing Sherpa, was tapped, right? He wasn't going to carry my skis up and down. So he had actually already identified which of his on his Sherpa team would carry my skis down. And I said, oh, no, thank you so much, though. I'm going to wear them down.
And just to clarify then, who were the other people who were with you who were going to ski and, you know, help with the belaying and things?
Most people would probably recognize the name Jimmy Chin, who's a great friend of both Rob's and mine. And he was with us to ski and he did ski. And his job was also to document via photography. And then Rob Delorier, who at the time was my husband of 6 years. But so it was Rob and Jimmy and I who were skiing. And then Dave Hahn was up there. And there was one other Westerner, I'll call. And that's a Canadian, Bryce Brown, who was already friends with Wally Berg and had tagged onto our permit wanting to climb it at that time. So he was climbing on his own.
So you mentioned earlier that you were probably going to need a belay, from the Hillary Step. But that first piece of skiing, you've put your skis on, you've got your boots on. I'm wondering, you know, if it's possible even to describe how you felt when you kind of pushed off the summit, you know, and started to ski on that seventh and most highest mountain.
My heart was ripped wide open. I felt so much love and gratitude after I accepted those skis and stepped into my bindings and I looked around at everybody there. I had an experience where I didn't just see those people, very much I did. I could actually see everybody that was in support of those people and everybody who had been in support of me, like in the sky, in a distance. And I had so much gratitude for what everybody had done and the way that they had enabled me to be in this position. They hadn't put me in this position, but they had very much enabled me to be in that position. And I literally cried tears of gratitude. And then I set off skiing down the ridge and actually there was Sherpa in my way. It was funny because they still didn't believe I was going to ski. I had to ask them to move.
Wow, it is amazing. You know, I think if you really want to hear understand the full story of the climb to the summit of Everest, you do need to read the book. But we mentioned, you know, you skied the first section, there was some belaying, you stopped at Camp 4 overnight. And then the next day, skied down what sounded like an absolutely horrific section on the Lhotse face. At one point, you talk about how you were skiing with one ski pole in one hand and an ice axe in the other hand, and then swapping them over after every turn just to make sure that you wouldn't fall off the mountain.
Yeah. Well, the Lhotse face direct from Camp 4 is a climbing route that is also called the South Pillar route. And it had never been skied before, and it has never been skied since. So in 2026, we'll have the 20th anniversary of our ski descent. And to have a line like that, that hasn't been repeated in 20 years, I could not have foreseen that. And it is that dangerous and that difficult to set off on skis from 26,000 feet, from 8,000 meters, and ski a line that is over 1,500 meters vertical without a natural terrain feature that would give even a single break. And it increases in steepness from beginning at around 45 degrees, I'd say, quickly to well over 50 degrees. And then it maintains that for the duration of that 1,500 plus meters. It was icy. It was almost all ice. I had this experience where I could all of my skiing experiences culminated there. It was the most difficult thing I'd ever done. I was asked afterwards what degree of perfection I had to have, like what margin of error could I have there? And it was less than 0.1% is what I would say. Everything had to be so on. And it took us, I believe it was 1 hour and 54 minutes to make that part of the ski descent to come out across the Bergschrund back down into the Western Coombe.
Yeah, I mean, it's just terrifying listening to you talking about it.
It was remarkable. It was the best thing it was the most amazing thing I've ever done also. And in my Buddhist exploration since then, with a really special person named Pakchuk Rinpoche, a 13-time reincarnate Rinpoche from Nepal, who's become a good friend. I asked him to help me figure out what it was I was feeling at the bottom of that, right? Because I grabbed Jimmy's photo and snapped a selfie. And just the feeling when I look at that photo, the feeling that I have is so clear to me in recalling it. And I would often say to people that it's when I felt the most alive. And Rinpoche said to me, when I asked him for his input, he said, it's when you felt the closest to impermanence.
Yeah, I love that. Wow. I mean, it's such an incredible story. And evidently, you know, I recommend the book. I mean, I think you said at one point writing the book was harder than skiing the seven summits. Listening to you talking now, it kind of sounds quite hard. You know, I can see how it would have been very cathartic writing it. And just, you know, one of the points of podcasts like this is to help your story be more widely known, because I didn't come across it till I read the book. And it's just incredible. I can see when you've achieved something so amazing and so unique like that, it can be difficult to know what to do next. And we could probably do another podcast entirely. But I do want to ask you about another area that you've moved on to more recently within that spirit of adventure, because you started a family, you know, after the Seven Summits was complete. But more recently, you've been involved more in advocacy. And specifically, I think that was driven by a trip to the Brooks Range in Alaska, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a trip that you did up there. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
I'd be happy to. Well, glossing over the intentionally starting a family doesn't do it all justice, because it's all tied together, right? I intentionally became a mother and times two, had two daughters 18 months apart shortly after getting back from Everest, began that journey. So my first was born 13 months after coming off of Everest, 13, 14 months later. Then while I was pregnant with the second one, I began to wonder what would really be next, as I was so engrossed in that like 3-year journey of becoming a mom twice. And I would literally hole myself up and spend hours while a babysitter is watching my kids, thinking about where I wanted to go next. And I didn't want to have children to go back to a 7-week trip, right, to the Himalayas. I didn't want to be gone from them that long. But I realized that I still needed to have deep exploration for myself, for my own being, for my own soul to feel complete. And I landed on Alaska. And I had already had a number of experiences in Alaska, not just Denali. I love Alaska. I've been going there since I was 19. And I had heard about the Brooks Range when I was 19. So I decided to go up there. And I did some research and realized that some of the highest peaks in the Brooks Range hadn't been skied yet. And I thought, oh, this is perfect. I also was aware The coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge has been poised to be open to oil and gas development since at least 1980, when it was established in its current formulation with the what we call the 1002 zone, the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge being held out in some congressional provisions for not being granted wilderness status because it does have gas and oil. Yet there's a lot of other reasons for resources there to protect the area. So it can only be opened by an act of Congress, which it technically is now, but since December 2017. So that piece of it I do work in advocacy for. I'm currently board president for Alaska Wilderness League, and I've been on that board for 7 years, mostly in advocacy for making sure that the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge remains wilderness quality. Anyway, I went up there. I've been going up there on climbing and skiing expeditions since 2010 now, and I'm the first person to climb and ski the five highest mountains in the Brooks Range, and they're all in the Arctic Refuge.
That's pretty amazing. And I read in the book as well that, you know, despite these amazing mountains, highest mountains in different continents across the world, it feels like you have a connection there with that Brooks Range that's giving you a real connection with the landscape. I mean, we talked about wilderness earlier in Wyoming and Idaho, but it's even more so as wild as it can be there, right?
It is. I like to say that it's as pristine as when any, you know, human bipeds set foot on this continent of North America. It's nearly 20 million acres, roadless, trailless, no bridges, no signs. You're out there. You're very much a guest and a visitor. And I've had experiences skiing deep up canyons on my way to the highest peaks where there's only room for me and my skis, and yet there's wolf tracks right underneath my feet. And so for a solid day, I'm wondering, oh my gosh, is it okay to actually ski over these wolf tracks, right? And then I have this experience where I can see where the wolf goes up and over the mountain. And I learn, I'm like, oh, well, if I wanted to connect to that drainage, that's how I go. And you're just so a part of it, right? I've seen polar bear, I've seen wolverines. I don't have to go there for 7 weeks at a time. I can go for three and have as rewarding experiences as or more so than I've had on any of these other mountains.
Fantastic. And you've had the opportunity mentioned, I think you've taken your children to Nepal. You've taken your children up to the Brooks Range as well?
Oh, yes. They were 5 and 6 years old, and I took them on a river trip. We spent a good 8 days deep in wilderness there. A lot of brown bear encounters and fishing and rafting and hiking and, you know, seeing doll sheep and muskox and watching my kids just, you know, play with rocks on the riverbanks and soak it all up. They still say that all the places they've been in the world, that's their favorite.
Well, that sounds like a really great point to finish this. I mean, it's been so interesting talking to you, Kit. You know, as soon as I read the book, I thought straight away, oh, you know, got to work out if I can interview her, because this is such an amazing story. So I really appreciate you, you know, joining us and sharing all of those experiences with us. I think, you know, two things that come to mind are resilience and determination. It is truly inspiring. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it. When I wrote the book, I needed to write the story. And a lot of people asked me for more than I could give in a 45-minute or an hour conversation. So that's why I wrote it. And it was very light on the promotion. And I really appreciate this opportunity, even, you know, 10 years after I published it, to continue to share it, because I think it's fairly timeless, the messages that I have to share through it. So thank you.
That's brilliant, Kit. Thanks very much.
Hopefully you enjoyed my conversation with Kit as much as I did. I highly recommend you read the book. It really is a tremendous read. Right. I always enjoy listener feedback. I love to hear what you think about the show. You can leave me a comment on Spotify, Instagram or Facebook. Our handle is @theskipodcast, or drop me an email to skipodcast@gmail.com. Hopefully, listener, you have already completed our 2025 listener survey. It's not quite too late yet. I will be picking a winner on Monday morning. So if you haven't yet completed it, please take the link in the show notes now. And as well as giving me valuable feedback, you're going to draw to win £400 worth of prizes. And I have to say, the comments so far have been really interesting. I will share some of them at theskipodcast.com in due course. But a lot of you clearly have your own skis and boots, so no wonder our equipment episodes are so popular. Plus, 75% of you go to the mountains more than twice every winter. So that makes sense that the features you want are most about destinations, and in particular off the beaten track destinations. So this week's episode, covering Elvis, Kilimanjaro and Mount Elbrus, should be right up your street. All comments are anonymous, but I did want to read out a couple I particularly appreciated. One says, "It's really excellent work you've done over the years and you're still delivering. I really appreciate the way you keep it free from advertorial type content. I also like this comment. The ski podcast does exactly what I hope. Allows me to vicariously enjoy extra skiing experiences at a time of my life when I can usually only get to the Alps twice a year." So if that was you, thanks for those comments. And thanks to everybody who has completed the survey. There are now 286 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and 151 of them we listened to in the last week. So listener, if you enjoyed this episode, then all you need to do is go to theskipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find plenty more to listen to. In the last week, just over half our listeners were in the UK, around 20% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Pakistan, Peru, and Nigeria. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. If you'd like to help the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. You can follow us or subscribe. You can give us a review on Apple Podcasts or leave a comment on Spotify. And if you're booking ski hire this winter, don't forget you can save money on your ski hire with an additional discount using the code SKIPODCAST when you book at InSportRent.com. Simply take the link in the show notes for that discount to be automatically applied. Right, for now, I'd like to thank Kit for sharing her time today and sharing this amazing story with us. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.